You know, when we try to picture a global health emergency, I feel like our minds almost automatically default to like the movies.
Right, the whole Hollywood version of a pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. We imagine hazmat suits everywhere, sirens blaring through abandoned streets, people instantly collapsing in the supermarket. It's loud, right? It's highly cinematic.
It is. I mean, it relies entirely on that visual spectacle to scare you.
But the reality, especially with the news that just dropped on May 15th, 2026, is a lot quieter. And frankly, I think it's a lot more terrifying.
Yeah.
On that day, the Democratic Republic of the Congo declared its 17th Ebola epidemic, this time in the Ituri province.
And, you know, the escalation of that was incredibly rapid. Just 2 days later, the World Health Organization actually escalated the situation. They declared this epidemic a public health emergency of international concern.
Which is a huge deal.
It is. We were suddenly looking at 246 suspected cases, 80 deaths, and the virus was actively crossing the border into Uganda.
Yeah, it's exactly the kind of news alert that just makes your stomach drop. You know, it immediately triggers panic across social media.
Oh, absolutely.
But for this deep dive, our goal is to kind of strip away that sensationalism of the news cycle and definitely ignore the wild exaggerations of those pandemic
Right,
movies.
we want to stick to the facts.
Exactly. We are relying entirely on a massive, really comprehensive Wikipedia repository of medical, historical, and epidemiological data on the Ebola
And
virus.
it is incredibly thorough.
It is. So the mission for you listening right now is to understand exactly how this microscopic killer actually operates, where it comes from, the deeply human history of its discovery, and the incredible medical breakthroughs that are finally giving humanity a fighting chance. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to ground our investigation, I think it helps to clearly define what we are actually dealing with here. Ebola, or formerly known as Ebola virus disease, is a zoonotic viral hemorrhagic fever.
And just to clarify, zoonotic is just the scientific term, meaning it originates in animals and jumps to humans, right?
Exactly. It jumps the species barrier. Historically, outbreaks of this disease have carried an average mortality rate of about 50%.
Wow, 50%.
Yeah. And in certain environments, that number has actually climbed as high as 90%.
That is just staggering.
It really is. But to defeat a pathogen with that kind of kill rate, we first have to understand the mechanics of why it is so incredibly lethal.
Right. And I want you, the listener, to picture this as almost like a forensic investigation.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, because to truly understand the global terror this disease causes, we have to zoom way, way in and look at the crime scene inside a single human body.
And when you look at the biology of the virus at that level, its simplicity is almost insulting.
Insulting is a good word for it.
We are talking about a single-stranded RNA virus. Under an electron microscope, it doesn't look like some menacing alien sphere covered in spikes, you know?
Right, like the classic COVID illustrations we're all used to seeing.
Exactly. It doesn't look like that. It actually looks like a microscopic piece of thread. It's a filamentous particle. Usually it's shaped like a shepherd's crook or a U or sometimes a six.
Just a little squiggly line.
It's a little line. It's only about 80 nanometers wide.
But the part that absolutely blows my mind, its entire genome contains only seven genes.
Seven. That's it.
I mean, for a sense of scale, a single human cell has over 20,000 genes.
Right. It's a massive difference.
It's like, imagine a hacker bringing down an entire global banking system with just seven lines of code.
That is exactly the level of biological sabotage Ebola is executing.
It's wild. Now, before we look at how those seven genes actually run their code, let's clear up the clinical reality.
Good idea.
Because of pop culture, I think people assume catching this means you instantly start bleeding from your eyes and your pores in the middle of the street. What does the infection actually look like on the ground?
Well, the clinical reality is far more insidious, mostly because of how it starts. There is an incubation period that can last anywhere from 2 to 21 days.
So you could be infected for 3 weeks and not even know it.
Exactly. You're walking around feeling completely fine. Then, when the symptoms finally do hit, they perfectly mimic a sudden severe flu.
Like just normal flu stuff.
Yeah, you get extreme fatigue, a high fever, muscle pain, and a sore throat. It's only days later that the severe nausea, uncontrollable vomiting, and diarrhea really set in.
Okay, but what about the bleeding? Because the Hollywood trope is all about the blood.
Right. The heavy external bleeding is actually surprisingly uncommon.
Wait, really? Because the scientific classification is literally hemorrhagic fever. Like that implies massive bleeding.
I know, it does. And there's bleeding, but bleeding from mucous membranes or injection sites only happens in about 40 to 50% of cases.
So half the people don't bleed externally at all.
Exactly. When heavy bleeding does occur, it is usually internal. It specifically pools in the gastrointestinal tract.
Huh.
Yeah. The virus drastically decreases your blood's ability to clot, and it damages the cells lining your blood vessels. But here's the crucial distinction. The blood loss itself isn't usually what kills the patient.
Really? What is it then?
The real killer is hypovolemic shock.
Which is caused by the vomiting and diarrhea, right?
Precisely. The extreme gastrointestinal symptoms lead to massive, incredibly rapid fluid loss.
Right.
So the patient's overall blood volume plummets. And when that happens, their blood pressure just drops off a cliff.
Because there's not enough fluid to keep the pressure up.
Exactly. And without enough pressure to pump oxygenated blood throughout the body, your major organs simply fail from the shock.
And how fast does this happen?
This usually happens between 6 and 16 days after the first symptoms appear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which brings us right back to those 7 genes. How is a virus with such a tiny genetic payload managing to do so much catastrophic damage before the human immune system can even mount a proper defense?
Well, what's fascinating here is the sheer devastating elegance of its immune evasion. The virus produces two specific structural proteins known as VP24 and VP35.
Okay. VP24 and VP35.
You can think of them as a highly trained strike team taking out a bank's security cameras before the main heist begins.
Okay, I like that. Walk me through the heist.
So when a normal human cell detects a viral intruder, it panics. It sends out a chemical distress signal using proteins called interferons.
It's essentially a cellular alarm system. Like, one cell gets breached, so it screams to the neighboring cells to lock their doors.
That's the exact mechanism, yeah. Those interferons bind to neighboring cells, which triggers a specific signaling protein. It's called STAT1.
Yeah, STAT1.
Right. And STAT1 rushes into the cell's nucleus to turn on the production of antiviral defenses. But Ebola's VP24 protein physically blocks that STAT1 signaling protein from entering the nucleus.
So it barricades the door.
Literally. The neighboring cells never get the message to lock down.
Wow. So the alarm is completely silenced at the receiver's end.
And at the source, actually. Meanwhile, that second protein, the VP35 protein, directly inhibits the originally infected cell from even producing the interferon distress signal in the first place.
It cuts the alarm wires completely.
Completely. Without the innate immune system slowing it down, the virus replicates uncontrollably. And it doesn't just attack any cell. It specifically targets your immune system's first responders.
The very things meant to fight it.
Yeah. The specialized white blood cells that normally patrol your body, looking to consume pathogens.
So it hijacks the exact cells designed to protect us, turns them into like virus printing factories, and then causes them to self-destruct.
Exactly. And that cell death unleashes a massive storm of inflammation throughout the entire body.
So knowing how efficiently this virus dismantles human biology definitely explains the high death toll. But I mean, if it's so perfectly adapted to destroying human cells, it begs the question, where is it practicing when it's not inside us? Like, how does it make the jump?
Finding the natural reservoir of this virus actually required decades of intense ecological detective work.
I can imagine.
Yeah, between 1976 and 1998, field researchers tested over 30,000 mammals, birds, reptiles, and insects from outbreak regions across Africa.
30,000?
Yeah, they were desperately looking for the virus's hiding spot.
And the prime suspect they eventually landed on was the fruit bat. Right.
Specifically, researchers identified 3 types of fruit bat that can carry the virus in their systems without ever getting sick.
So their immune systems just somehow tolerate the pathogen perfectly?
Which makes them the ideal biological vessel. I mean, they fly vast distances every single night, dropping partially eaten fruit, saliva, or guano into the deep forest.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the jump from those bats to humans isn't just a matter of random bad luck. It is deeply tied to how human beings are actually altering the environment.
Yes, that is a crucial point.
Outbreaks are consistently triggered by deforestation and climate change. When severe droughts hit Central Africa, it creates intense food insecurity, and logging destroys the deep forest canopies.
So you end up pushing these infected bat populations out of their natural habitats.
Exactly. They get pushed closer to human settlements just looking for food.
And it initiates this deadly domino effect. A stressed bat drops a piece of infectious fruit. Then a chimpanzee or gorilla or maybe a forest antelope eats that fruit and becomes infected.
Right. And because food crops have failed due to the drought, Human hunters in these local rural communities are forced to rely heavily on hunting these wild animals just for protein.
Bushmeat.
Yeah. The hunter comes into contact with the infected blood while butchering the meat, and boom, the virus successfully finds a new host.
And once it establishes that beachhead in the human population, the global fear immediately shifts to how it spreads.
Yeah, and I know exactly what you're thinking right now listening to this. You're probably picturing it spreading through the air on a crowded subway, like a common cold. We need to definitively debunk that right now.
It is the most critical distinction we can make today.
Yeah.
There have been zero documented cases, either in nature or in human outbreaks, of this virus spreading to the air from human to human.
Zero.
None. Human transmission requires direct physical contact with the blood, vomit, feces, or other bodily fluids of a person who is actively showing symptoms.
Right. It has to enter your body through broken skin or mucous membranes, like your eyes, nose, or mouth.
Exactly.
You aren't going to get infected just by breathing the air in the same room as someone unless, I mean, they are so severely ill that they are violently coughing or sneezing large, wet, infectious droplets directly onto your face.
Which requires very close proximity.
Exactly. But as with any forensic investigation, our source material throws us one bizarre curveball that completely complicates the whole theory.
Ah, yes. This raises an important question, and it stems from a highly unusual laboratory incident involving pigs.
Pigs?
Yes. Researchers discovered that pigs infected with a specific strain of the virus, the Restin strain, actually could transmit it through the air to primates in a laboratory setting.
Without any direct physical contact whatsoever.
Exactly.
Wait, so it's a completely airborne transmission, but only if it's coming from pigs?
Yes.
If it's airborne in pigs, that means the virus must behave differently in their anatomy than in ours, right? Does it attack their respiratory system instead of their blood?
Spot on. It comes down to where the virus physically accumulates in the host. In humans and other primates, the virus replicates aggressively throughout the body and specifically concentrates in the blood and the GI tract.
Okay.
But in pigs, the virus accumulates in massive localized concentrations directly inside their lungs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when an infected pig exhales, sneezes, or coughs, it is expelling huge, dense clouds of the virus into the air. Primate lungs simply don't harbor the virus the same way.
Terrifying, sure, but also a massive relief that our human lungs don't turn into virus cannons.
A huge relief.
But because human transmission requires such intimate contact with fluids, it means the history of these epidemics is deeply tied to human behavior.
Yeah.
Specifically, the danger zones are caregiving and mourning.
Right. That intimate, tragic connection is visible from the very first recorded outbreaks. We can trace the formal discovery of the virus back to 1976.
To two simultaneous outbreaks in Central Africa, right?
Yes. One was in Sudan, and the other was in a small rural village called Yambuku that was in what was then Zaire, now the DRC.
The story of the Yambuku outbreak is incredibly heartbreaking.
It really is.
So in August of 1976, a village school headmaster named Mabalo Lokela returned from a trip near the Ebola River. He fell ill with a very high fever, and at first the local clinic just assumed he had a severe case of malaria.
Which is incredibly common in that region.
Right.
And because the initial symptoms mimic malaria so perfectly, they treated him with quinine.
But obviously his symptoms just kept worsening. Severe pain, vomiting blood, extreme exhaustion. He died 14 days after his symptoms started.
A tragic loss.
But the true tragedy is how his treatment inadvertently started the fire.
This is where the fragility of local healthcare infrastructure becomes the virus's greatest weapon. Lokela was treated at the Yambuku Mission Hospital, which was operated by Belgian nuns.
Okay.
At the time, they were routinely giving vitamin injections to pregnant women at the clinic, but they were operating with severe supply shortages. They were reusing just 5 glass syringes for the entire hospital.
Oh, no.
And crucially, they were not properly sterilizing the needles between patients.
They were essentially creating a biological superhighway, just injecting the virus directly into the bloodstream of dozens of unsuspecting patients.
Yes. The outbreak exploded, ultimately killing 280 of the 318 people infected in Zaire.
That is an 88% fatality rate? That is terrifying.
It is. The local doctors were instrumental in getting blood samples shipped to Belgium, though. That's where a researcher named Peter Piet and his team finally isolated the new unknown virus under a microscope.
And they named it after the nearby Ebola River to avoid stigmatizing the village of Yambuku.
Right. And for years after that discovery, the narrative of the disease remained mostly confined to these devastating but highly localized outbreaks in remote African villages.
Until 1989,
right,
when the story took a wild turn that brought the virus right to the suburbs of the United States.
The Reston incident.
Honestly, this reads exactly like a thriller novel. A research facility in Reston, Virginia, which is just a few miles from Washington, D.C., received a routine shipment of macaque monkeys from the Philippines.
And suddenly the monkeys start dying off rapidly from a mysterious hemorrhagic fever.
So the facility sends tissue samples to the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute. An electron microscopist looks at the sample and sees that unmistakable shepherd's crook shape.
They realize they have an active filovirus outbreak sitting in a suburban office park.
Panic naturally ensues. Mm-hmm. A military team in full biohazard gear has to come in, euthanize the surviving monkeys, and systematically decontaminate the entire building.
But the real shock wasn't the monkeys. It was the human handlers.
Right. Blood samples were taken from the facility workers. Six of them tested positive for the virus. One handler had even accidentally sliced his finger open with a bloody scalpel while performing an autopsy on an infected monkey.
That should have been a death sentence.
Absolutely. But none of them got sick?
Not a single symptom.
Which had to be the most confusing relief in medical history.
It forced the CDC to realize they were dealing with a completely new strain, which they named the Reston virus.
The pick one from earlier.
Exactly. While it was highly lethal to macaques, it had a very low pathogenicity for humans. It could enter human cells and replicate enough to trigger antibodies, but it simply didn't cause the actual disease.
So it was a massive sigh of relief, yes, but it proved how easily these pathogens could hide in commercial cargo and cross international borders undetected.
Which tragically foreshadowed the darkest chapter in the history of the disease, the 2013 to 2016 West African epidemic.
Yeah. Unlike previous outbreaks that were contained to isolated rural villages, this one managed to reach densely populated urban centers in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
Epidemiologists achieved an incredible feat by tracing that entire massive epidemic back to a single index case.
One case.
It started with a one-year-old child in a remote Guinean village who died in December 2013. Likely after playing near a hollow tree infested with fruit bats.
That is heartbreaking.
It is. From that single child, the virus slowly burned through the community, eventually reaching the capital cities and spreading across borders.
The numbers are just staggering. Over 28,000 people were infected and more than 11,300 died. It became the largest outbreak ever documented. But why did it get so out of control there compared to the localized outbreaks of the 70s and 80s?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the West African epidemic exposed the severe vulnerabilities of the region's health security. You had a highly mobile population moving through densely packed urban slums. But more importantly, the local health infrastructures were completely overwhelmed and lacked basic resources. We're talking about clinics without sufficient protective equipment, and in some cases, without running water to wash hands.
So the actual places people went to get help became the hubs of infection.
Precisely. The WHO reported that at one point, 10% of the dead were healthcare workers.
10%.
The doctors and nurses caring for the sick were paying the ultimate price. Without the ability to safely isolate patients or safely handle the highly infectious bodies of the deceased during traditional burial rites, the hospitals and funerals essentially functioned as amplifiers for the virus.
It was an absolute wake-up call for the entire world. The horrifying scale of that epidemic forced the global medical community's hand, basically kick-starting unprecedented research and funding.
Yes, it changed everything.
For decades, if you got infected, doctors couldn't offer much more than standard supportive care, basically hooking you up to an IV for hydration and managing your pain while hoping your immune system won the literal war happening inside your veins.
Just weeding it out.
Right, but the post-2016 landscape, it is completely different. We are finally mounting a massive medical counterattack.
The shift in therapeutics has been nothing short of monumental. By 2019, clinical trials in the DRC yielded incredible results using monoclonal antibodies.
Let's break that down because it sounds like heavy medical jargon. Like, how exactly do those work?
Essentially, scientists managed to engineer synthetic immune proteins in a laboratory.
Okay.
So instead of waiting for the patient's compromised immune system to figure out how to fight the virus, they flood the patient's body with these lab-made proteins.
Gotcha.
These synthetic antibodies act like microscopic caps. They physically bind to the outside of the virus, completely blocking it from being able to dock with and enter human cells.
Oh, that's brilliant. It's like changing the locks on the doors before the virus can even turn the key.
Exactly. And in trials, treatments like Inmazeb and Ensuvimab were found to be highly effective if administered early enough. That alone is a game changer. But perhaps even more significantly, we finally have a highly effective FDA-approved vaccine, the RVSV-ZBOV vaccine.
Yes. And its deployment has totally revolutionized outbreak response, right? During the massive Kivu epidemic in the DRC between 2018 and 2020, health organizations utilized a strategy called ring vaccination.
I did.
How exactly does that work in practice? Because they aren't just vaccinating everyone in the country, right?
Right. That would be impossible.
Yeah.
Think of it like cutting a fire break in a forest to stop a wildfire.
Yeah.
You don't try to put out the entire fire. You remove the fuel directly around it.
Oh, I see.
When a patient is confirmed positive, teams frantically track down every single person that patient had contact with, and they vaccinate all of them. They track down the contacts of those contacts and vaccinate them too.
You build a literal biological wall of immunity around the virus so it has nowhere left to jump.
Exactly.
And doing that in the Kivu region meant navigating an active, violent conflict zone, like negotiating with armed militias just to get coolers of vaccines to remote villages. It's an unbelievable logistical triumph.
Truly heroic work.
So, with treatments and vaccines, does the story end when a patient clears the virus from their blood and finally gets to go home?
Unfortunately, no. The aftermath is an area of intense ongoing study. Many survivors face a grueling reality known as post-Ebola syndrome.
Right.
The acute life-threatening infection is gone, but their bodies have been to war. They suffer from severe joint pain, chronic fatigue, hearing loss, and dangerous liver inflammation.
But the part of the research that I found most unsettling is the concept of immunologically privileged sites. The virus can actually hide out in the body, right?
Yes. There are specific areas of the human body where our immune system intentionally operates at a lower capacity.
Why would it do that?
It's an evolutionary choke designed to prevent aggressive immune inflammation from permanently damaging vital delicate tissue. The eyes, the central nervous system, and the testes are prime examples.
Okay, that makes sense.
But because the immune system isn't constantly patrolling these specific areas with lethal force, the virus can seek refuge and persist there long after it has been completely wiped out from the bloodstream.
I read about this chilling case from 2014 in the sources. A patient survived, his blood tested completely clear, and he was officially discharged. But 2 months later, his vision starts failing rapidly.
Yes.
Doctors examine his eye and find the live virus swimming freely in his aqueous fluid. It's like a ghost lingering in the system.
It is deeply troubling. It causes severe ocular inflammation. We also know that the virus can persist in semen for highly extended periods.
Right.
National screening programs in West Africa recorded the virus persisting in survivors for over a year after their initial recovery.
A whole year.
Over a year. And while it's rare, this has led to documented cases of sexual transmission, sparking brand new chains of infection months after an outbreak was officially declared over.
Wow.
It means that supporting survivors isn't just about basic compassion. It is a critical, mandatory component of ongoing public health surveillance.
So what does this all mean? When we look back at the scope of this deep dive, this virus is truly a masterclass in biological efficiency. It's a tiny 80-nanometer thread carrying just 7 genes, yet it manages to exploit the very best parts of our humanity.
Our instinct to care.
Exactly. Our instinct to physically care for our sick and our deeply held traditions of washing and honoring our dead. It exploits our encroachment into the natural world. Yet, through rigorous, exhausting contact tracing, global cooperation, and cutting-edge synthetic antibodies and vaccines, humanity has managed to turn a once unstoppable ghost into a manageable, preventable disease.
It is a profound medical victory, without question, but it leaves us with a critical ongoing challenge to ponder.
What's that?
We discussed the environmental triggers earlier, deforestation and climate change.
Right, pushing the fruit bats out of the deep forests.
Exactly. We know that these environmental shifts are pushing animal reservoirs closer to human settlements. They're creating the perfect conditions for spillover events.
So it's not just random bad luck.
No. As we continue to clear the world's most remote forests for resources, and as severe droughts worsen, we are directly forcing these pathogens out of hiding.
It's almost like we're setting our own traps.
Precisely. We have these amazing medical miracles now, but we have to ask ourselves a difficult question. Are we just treating the symptom by creating these brilliant vaccines, while actively ignoring the environmental disease that guarantees the next unknown virus is already on its way to meet us.
That is a staggering realization and a really heavy, necessary thought to leave on. We might have stripped away the loud cinematic Hollywood version of an outbreak today, but the quiet reality, the microscopic leaps from bat to human, the deforestation, the silent spread before the alarm sounds, that is a reality we all need to be paying very close attention to.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.